as the music fades away, let me be the first to welcome you all to the inaugural episode of Roshcast. Hey Nachi, since this is your brainchild, what's it all about?
Well, our vision for Roshcast is to create the first ever high-yield board review question bank podcast to help you during your in-service preparation and on your never-ending path to becoming a better clinician.
Like most EM practitioners, we've come to know and love the various educational podcasts. We love MCRIT for cutting-edge ED critical care and EM Basic or Foamcast for the fundamentals, but something is clearly lacking. So our goal for Roshcast is to fill that void and directly challenge the listeners with questions.
We want to take the extensively vetted questions from Rosh Review to the airwaves. After each question, we're going to review the other answer choices and try to go a little beyond. Then at the end of each episode, we'll review pertinent pearls from all of the questions.
Yeah, and we're going to keep the episodes really short, 10 to 15 minute max, as you'll need to be actively engaged to get the most out of it. Although you're still going to have to power through the question bank the old-fashioned way, i.e. an iPhone or an iPad, there's no better way than to get a little bonus studying on your way into or out of a shift.
Perfect. Let's get started, Jeff. You're up first. A two-year-old girl presents to the ED, reluctant to move her left arm. The patient's father states that he grabbed her by her wrist to pull her up from the floor. On exam, there's no swelling or deformity. Which of the following maneuvers should be attempted to correct the injury? Is it A, elbow flexion followed by pronation, B, hypersupination of the forearm, C, pronation followed by elbow flexion, or D, supination followed by elbow flexion?
In this question, you're describing nursemaid's elbow, which is treated by choice D, supination followed by elbow flexion. Although not a choice here, hyperpronation can also be attempted.
Good job, Jeff. Remind me, what is a nursemaid's elbow?
Nursemaid's elbow is subluxation of the radial head due to displacement of the radial annular ligament into the radial capitellar articulation. It commonly occurs in children 2 to 3 years old and is more common in females. The x-ray is typically normal and the child appears well but refuses to move their affected arm. All right, Nachi, let's transition from the really young to the really old. We're headed to the geriatric ED. A 63-year-old man presents with aphasia that started 30 minutes prior to arrival. He is unable to give any history. His vitals are unremarkable, and his exam is significant only for a profound aphasia. His glucose is 124. You appropriately rush him to the scanner, which shows an unremarkable head CT. 60 minutes after arrival, his aphasia resolves completely. Which is the most appropriate diagnosis, treatment, and disposition for this patient? Is it A, hypertensive emergency, start IV antihypertensive therapy and admit to the medical intensive care unit? B, stroke, administer TPA and admit to stroke unit? C, TIA, administer aspirin and dipyramidol, admit to the stroke unit? D, TIA, administer low molecular weight heparin and warfarin, discharge home with close neurology follow-up? Or E, TIA, start heparin infusion and admit to the stroke unit.
Well, since his symptoms resolved within 3 hours, you're describing a TIA. The current class 1A recommendation for the treatment of TIA is to administer aspirin alone or aspirin plus dipyridamole and admit to the stroke unit for risk factor assessment, which means the correct answer choice here was C.
Is that really the current recommendation? That seems awfully aggressive for patients without any symptoms at all.
Yeah, Jeff, the 90-day risk of subsequent stroke is 9.5% in those diagnosed with a TIA. The risk of stroke increases in patients older than 60, patients with hypertension, diabetes, or those whose symptoms are associated with weakness or speech impairments.
Interesting. Is there any way to risk stratify patients who have had TIAs?
You can use the ABCD2 score, which predicts the likelihood of subsequent stroke within 2 days. A is for age. You get 1 point for being older than 60. B is for blood pressure. You get 1 point for a systolic greater than 140 or a diastolic greater than 90. C is for the clinical symptoms of TIA, 2 points for unilateral weakness, 1 point for speech disturbance without weakness. And the D is for duration of symptoms, 1 point for symptoms lasting 10 to 59 minutes and 2 points for symptoms lasting an hour or longer.
That's pretty cool. I'll try it out next time I'm in the ER.
All right, on to one of the more difficult topics in emergency medicine. Dermatology. A 45-year-old woman presents to the ED with a rash seen here.
Seen? Nachi, this is a podcast. We can't see anything.
All right, fine. I'll describe it to you. The rash is a collection of edematous plaques with pale centers and red borders. It's an urticarial rash.
Thanks.
Which of the following is true regarding urticarial rashes? Is it A, they always appear in a dermatomal distribution? B, firm stroking of the skin produces a wheal? C, mucous membrane involvement becomes apparent during the progression phase? D, the rash is a mild form of Stevens-Johnson syndrome.
I'm going to go with choice B here. With hives, firm stroking of the skin produces a wheal. I know choice C, mucous membrane involvement becomes apparent during the progression phase, refers to TEN or SJS. Do you remember which one?
Nope.
Mucous membrane involvement is seen in Stevens-Johnson syndrome, not TEN. We'll come back to TEN in a later question. But before we move on, can you remind me of the treatment for urticaria?
Yes, finally, something I can answer. Mild to moderate urticaria is treated with antihistamines, plus or minus steroids.
That was way too easy. Let's go on.
Okay, Jeff, here's another one. A 19-year-old boy presents with a fever, sore throat, and difficulty swallowing for 4 days. It's so bad that he hasn't been able to swallow any liquids at all today. On physical exam, he has a muffled voice, difficulty tolerating saliva, and minimal pharyngeal erythema with a midline uvula. He has exquisite tenderness over the hyoid bone. Which of the following managements is most likely indicated? Is it A, inhaled racemic epi and discharge home, B, IV antibiotics and admission, C, IV steroids and discharge home, or D, needle aspiration of peritonsillar area?
Well, you're clearly describing epiglottitis, so I was hoping that intubation in the OR would have been a choice since that's always the answer, but it's not there, so help a brother out.
You're on the right track. Management is typically first focused at protecting the airways, sometimes requiring intubation. Since that's not an option here, the next best answer would be antibiotics and admission. Which antibiotics would you choose besides the ED cocktail of vancomycin?
Wait, vancomycin isn't the correct answer? It's always the correct answer. But since you're forcing me, epiglottitis is typically caused by either a virus or bacterial agents, with Haemophilus influenza type B being the most common agent. We could use either ceftriaxone or ampicillin sulbactam as our first-line agents of choice.
Correct. And if you were really, really comfortable or had an x-ray tech who is willing to do a portable neck, which characteristic finding would you see on a radiograph of the neck?
You're referring to the thumb sign, which is caused by edema of the epiglottis. An epiglottic width greater than 8 millimeters or an aeroepiglottic fold greater than 7 millimeters suggests epiglottitis.
Before we move on, let's quickly review the other answer choices. Racemic epi is only a temporizing measure to institute prior to controlling the airway. Steroids are not efficacious in epiglottitis, and needle aspiration of the peritonsillar area is the treatment of choice for a PTA, or a peritonsillar abscess.
Awesome. Let's move a little bit further down the airway and talk about the pediatric cough. Let's listen to this textbook cough. Given that cough you just heard, what is the most likely diagnosis? Is it A, chlamydia pneumonia, B, cough variant asthma, C, croup, or D, pertussis?
Well, that's a whooping cough, so that's going to be D, pertussis. The track you just played is clearly the classic unremitting paroxysmal cough followed by a whoop.
Correct. Let's review the three stages of the whooping cough. The first stage is called the catarrhal stage and lasts from 7 to 10 days. During this period, you usually see a mild fever, cough, coryza, and conjunctivitis. During days 7 to 28, or the paroxysmal stage, you typically see spasmodic fits of coughing followed by inspiratory stridor or a whoop. You can see up to 40 fits per day. In the final stage, or convalescent stage, that can last up to several months, you see the same paroxysmal symptoms that occur with decreasing frequency and decreasing severity of paroxysms.
Interesting. Thanks for that, Jeff. And what's the treatment for pertussis?
Pertussis can be treated with a macrolid antibiotic, like a Z-Pak, although erythromycin and clarithromycin can also be used. Let's move on. Which of the following is true about myasthenia gravis? Is it A, limb weakness and dysarthria are the most common presenting symptoms? B, muscle weakness tends to worsen after long periods of rest? Or C, optic neuritis is commonly associated with the condition? Or D, symptoms are decreased by cooling?
Well, in myasthenia gravis, symptoms are definitely decreased by cooling, so I'll go with D.
Absolutely correct. Can you explain the pathophysiology of myasthenia gravis?
Myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune disease that is characterized by muscle weakness and fatigue after repetitive use of voluntary muscles. Antibodies attack and reduce the number of nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, and that leads to a decrease in the response to acetylcholine. Cooling actually improves the symptoms because it slows the kinetics of the acetylcholine receptor, prolonging the effects of acetylcholine. If the patient has ptosis, you can actually place an ice pack over the affected eye for 2 minutes and watch the ptosis resolve.
Is there a more civil test we can do besides dropping an ice pack on the patient's face?
Well, there is. There's the edrophonium or tensilon test.
And what's the treatment besides ice?
Well, for acute crises, you can perform either plasma exchange or use IVIG.
Let's move on to surgery. After postoperative adhesions, which of the following conditions is most likely cause for a small bowel obstruction? Is it A, adenocarcinoma, B, incarcerated hernia, C, intussusception, or D, volvulus?
Well, after adhesions, the most common condition responsible for causing an SPO is cancer. So in this case, the answer would be A, adenocarcinoma. Cancer causes roughly 20% of SBOs, and incarcerated hernias cause approximately 10%.
Are adhesions also the most common cause of large bowel obstructions?
No, cancer is actually the most common cause of large bowel obstructions. The second most common cause of large bowel obstructions is volvulus.
And do you remember the classic X-ray finding associated with small bowel obstructions?
Yeah, you're referring to the string of pearls sign. Before we end, let's review with some high-yield pearls from today's episode.
Nursemaid's elbow is treated either with supination followed by elbow flexion or hyperpronation. Remember, the X-ray is typically normal.
TIAs are treated with aspirin and dipyridamole and must be admitted to the stroke unit for risk factor assessment. Patients with TIAs can be risk stratified by the ABCD2 score.
Mucous membrane involvement is seen in Stevens-Johnson syndrome and not in TEN.
Epiglottitis is treated first with airway management, then IV antibiotics and admission. Unicin or ceftriaxone are the antibiotics of choice.
Don't forget the classic paroxysmal whoop of pertussis. Remember, pertussis has three stages, the catarrhal, paroxysmal, and convalescent stage. Pertussis can be treated with macrolid antibiotics, like a Z-Pak.
In myasthenia gravis, symptoms are decreased by cooling. It can be diagnosed using the Tensilon test. Severe cases may be treated with IVIG or plasma exchange.
The number one cause of small bowel obstructions are postoperative adhesions, followed by cancer. Large bowel obstructions are caused first by cancer and second by volvulus.
All right, so that wraps up episode one. Jeff and I had a great time producing this, and we hope you enjoyed listening and learned something today, too.
Don't forget to keep your head on a swivel and be on the lookout for the next couple episodes coming up real soon.
Hey guys, this is Adam Rosh from Rosh Review. First, I want to thank Nachi and Jeff for doing a great job with their first podcast recording. This is not easy, and this is something new that we are trying out. So please send us feedback to feedback@roshreview.com. And let us know how we can improve any of the substance or even the style of the podcast. We really want to be able to provide you with just the right amount of high-yield information that you find value in. And just one more thing I want to mention. If you haven't heard my interview with Dr. Peter Rosen, you're going to want to check it out. It's Dr. Rosen like you've never seen him before. I've listened to many other interviews with Peter Rosen throughout my life and can honestly say this is one you do not want to miss. We go pretty deep and talk about everything from Dr. Rosen's morning rituals, his take on physician burnout, how he maintains a healthy marriage, parenting advice, who is the most successful person he knows, what books have shaped him personally and professionally, how two patients had such an impact on his career that he'll never forget them, some of his regrets, his views on podcasts, what he thinks he'll never get to do in life, what he wants to be remembered for, and much, much more. So just go to roshreview.com/blog or simply go to iTunes and search for Rosh Review. So thank you guys for listening. So long for now.